Welcome to the Hearts of Oak podcast. Hearts of Oak is a populist free speech alliance that seeks to push back the cultural Marxism that pervades all areas of our society. Free speech, religious disagreement, children's rights, and an open and free discussion on any topic are the bedrocks to a democratic free society, and we seek to promote and champion these basic rights. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Good evening, Hearts of Oak supporters, followers, viewers. Thank you so much for joining us on another live stream. This is coming to you as a pre-record a day before. You'll be watching this on Thursday, the 1st of April, or any day after that. So it's great to have you, however you're watching, whether it's on YouTube, on VK, on Rumble, on BitChute, on the website, Facebook, however it is, it's great to have you watching. And tonight we have a guest who we've had on before. A year ago around Easter time, I asked Pastor Wally Babatunde, who spoke at our launch, to join us and give his thoughts on Easter time. And this year I thought, why not ask Dr. Gavin Ashenden, who's with us, beginning of January. So, Gavin, thank you so much for giving us your time this evening.
Peter, it's a great pleasure to be with you. Thank you very much for having me on.
Not at all. It's great to have you. Now, I've been intrigued by one of your videos you've done recently, which was on Jordan Peterson. I hadn't watched the actual video until I watched your video. Then I went and watched Jordan's interview with Jonathan Pagu, I think his name is. And it was fascinating. But you had done a video, and then I see, looking at your website, you've done a podcast for The Spectator on it. Do you just want to let us know what the video was and why you made that before we jump into some of the issues?
Right. Well, I'll try and do the haiku version as briefly as I can. I first met Jordan Peterson when I was teaching psychology at a university, and we were covering the same kind of ground. And I discovered he'd written Maps of Meaning, and I was instantly very jealous because that was the book I wanted to write, and he'd clearly got there first and done such a good job of it. But at the time, I'd become a Jungian myself. But for some very good reasons, and mainly because my colleagues were profoundly influenced by Freud, or post-Freud, or post-post-Freud, or whichever wave of post-Freudian culture we'd reached. And Jung was a useful antidote to allow me to have conversations that were spiritual, metaphysical, moral, theological, with people that otherwise wouldn't have had the time for it, because they were all reductionist and empirical, and everything was to do with the repressed psyche. And Jung was different from Freud because, like Freud, he was trying to help people free from their neuroses and to develop a healthier relationship between consciousness and unconsciousness through the talking cure and psychoanalysis. But unlike Freud, he wanted to bring in a spiritual or a metaphysical dimension. The problem with the words is they mean different things to different people. And Jung was parasitic on Christianity. He used a lot of Christian language, but actually he was never a Christian and intended to subvert it all along. So God for him, there's a wonderful moment on a BBC Two program when he's asked, "Do you believe in God?" And he says, "I don't need to believe, I know." He was a Gnostic. What they failed to do was to ask him to define what the God he knew was. And for Jung, it was essentially the full development of the human self in an integrated way. Whenever you hear someone talking about living their life to the fullness of their potential, they're essentially living out the Jungian narrative. Now, if you're going to use Jung as an antidote to Freud, he's quite useful. If you're going to replace Orthodox Christianity with Jung, that's a problem. And actually, that's what our society has done. We've, about 20 or 30 years ago, Jung's ideas, particularly in the notion of polarities with a sliding scale in between that had to experience some kind of integration, whether it was to do with sexual identity or good and evil, or extrovert and introvert, provided a very useful way of mapping the relationship between the human consciousness and unconsciousness. But the problem was that although it sounded much like a psychological version of Christianity, it was in fact an old version of a sub-Christian Gnostic narcissistic religion. Now, why does that matter? Well, we have the paradox of Jordan Peterson as a Jungian standing up and saying the most extraordinarily powerful Christian things in the teeth of a disbelieving, angry, atheist, Marxist culture. And you'd expect that some Christian intellectual ought to have stood up and done that. You know, maybe Rowan Williams with a few injections of testosterone or something, and a greater sense of verbal clarity. But it was Jordan Peterson who, you know, I mean, even he didn't know it was going to happen to him. It just emerged out of his C-16 troubles in Ontario. But stuff that he had discovered as a psychologist, even as a Jungian, reaffirmed the Christian narrative in its essentials. You know, particularly the fact that hierarchies were a tribute to competence, not oppression. Particularly the fact that men and women were different, and if you pretended they weren't, you made people more unhappy, not less unhappy. Particularly the fact that you had to have freedom of speech to find out what you believed. And you'd think that people devoted to the logos, the word, would have got there before a Jungian psychologist, but we didn't. However, so Peterson found himself standing up on behalf of freedom of speech and hierarchy and exposing the price curve and the Pareto curve, and then crashed. Mm. I wasn't surprised he crashed, because I've always seen the culture wars as at least as spiritual and metaphysical as they are ideological.
Mm.
So, you know, things work at different levels. Of course they're a political and ideological struggle. But very often when things look mad and you can't find a rational explanation to cover the whole phenomenon, you need to go spiritual or metaphysical to complete a fuller picture of what's going on. And for some time now, I believe that this, you know, why is it that the woke movement makes a beeline for the Christians to go for their jugular? Why is it goes straight for the church to destroy the church? Why is it that it makes a beeline for Judeo-Christian ethics rather than Buddhist ethics or Muslim ethics or Epicurean ethics? Why is it all? And the answer is, well, it would do that if it was evil. And so I believe, and you know, there's no doubt at all that Marxism is a utopian sub-Christian heresy that's essentially a perversion of a whole load of good things.
Hmm.
And why might it be evil? Well, because it went straight for the church. It wiped out the clergy before it wiped out anybody else. So, you know, you could at least entertain the hypothesis that we're in the middle of a struggle between good and evil. And when you see all the Judeo-Christian ethical virtues being attacked, marriage, sexuality, freedom of speech, personal responsibility, and above all, the sanctity of the human person in the face of the most appalling infanticide masked as an abortion industry, you say, well, this is more than just a cultural struggle. It is that, but it's a struggle between good and evil. Well, if Jordan Peterson, as a good Jungian psychologist, is spearheading a struggle between good and evil when he doesn't understand evil because he's a Jungian, and he doesn't have the spiritual resources that Christians have when they're facing the demonic, he's going to be in trouble. And then I saw him crash and burn into something else, psychically, spiritually, psychologically, and I felt very sorry and very grateful for what he'd done. And I thought the very least I could do would be to try and offer a kind of spiritual narrative an interpretation of the dream, so to speak, and say, you know, he's done what he's done for the church, for goodness, for the kingdom of heaven, unknowingly for Christ. But he needs to come on board fully. He can no longer afford to believe in Christ as an archetypal key that opens the door of myth and meaning. He's got to meet him as his savior, his Lord, and his God, and drop down on his knees like Thomas and say, please may I touch and so believe. So I put a video up saying some of these things, partly hoping it might actually come to him, not in order to flag myself up in any particular way, but in order to try and bring some clarity to the conversations he'd had. Mm. He'd just had a very moving conversation with Jonathan Padgett, who's an Orthodox iconographer whom he trusted and liked. And it was particularly in the context of this vulnerability and honesty that part one of a conversation took place, to which I thought there ought to be a part two and a part three.
No, absolutely. I certainly, after watching your commentary on it, I enjoyed going back in and watching the actual interview. And one line which stuck out with me, which I will not ask you to unpack because we could be here a lot longer, that what the line or the phrase which you used, which stuck in my head, was moral idealism is not enough. That Jordan had come to that view that moral idealism was not enough. And to me, that was, wow, that changes how you look at who God is and why you would come to God if you realize that moral idealism does not make sense of what we see around us and is not enough. But we could unpack that for a long time, and I would love to, but we'll not. And next week we've got Robert Spencer on. So that's the book,
wow.
The Truth About Muhammad, which is one of the many books. But that was one of the first books I picked up and read when I began to understand Islam and what Islam taught. That will probably not be on YouTube. We'll have it on every other platform but YouTube. It might be too much for YouTube, and we're already in their doghouse twice, and I don't want to get them to have an excuse to give us a third strike. So that'll be Robert Spencer on. I'm looking at my calendar in front of me. That'll be Thursday the 8th. And then on Thursday the 15th, looking forward to having Christine Douglas Williams, and she wrote this book, which is The Challenge of Modernizing Islam. And she speaks to about eight different those within Islam who want to change it, who want to look at how it fits into the 21st century, and they give their views on how that can happen. So I'm looking forward to that, a fantastic conversation with her. And then later on, we have Diana West again, who's going to come and talk about 100 days of Biden. Again, because of the title we've chosen, that probably won't be YouTube either. We had a conversation today discussing it, and she said, no, she wants to go full on. So full on means it's not YouTube friendly. So it'll be on anything else. So that, just wanted to let our viewers know we have a couple of things coming up. But I watching your piece on Jordan Peterson, I'll probably have a nightmare about interviewing Jordan Peterson, because that would probably be the most difficult. I've watched many interviews that he's done with people, and I wonder how you even begin to tackle someone who is so complex and connects with so many people. But anyway, on to some of the dark issues that we face currently in our society, Gavin, before we move on to how we can find some hope in the situation we find ourselves in. And probably the darkest, the most difficult situation, which none of us have probably ever experienced, unless some of our viewers maybe were living through the Second World War, would be COVID. A pandemic, a lockdown causing economic destruction, having zero human contact. That's really shocked me. Families being cut off, grandparents not being able to see their grandchildren, not having any of that contact. Simple things like weddings and funerals, which are at the center of not only society, but of life. Those have not been able to happen, or happen very differently. Sports not happening, and church doors shut in a time where you would think the church should be needed more than ever to give some voice of hope and optimism, that their doors are shut. And I wonder what your thoughts are on what we've experienced as someone who's lived through it, but also as a church leader.
Well, it's very complex, and doing this in an orderly way will be a challenge to the untidiness of my brain. So let's very briefly pick out a number of issues and comment on them. So first of all, I had COVID after Christmas, and it was very unpleasant. Every bone in my body hurt, and I began to have breathing difficulties at one point, and I thought I'd go to hospital too. I didn't want to drown, which is the experience, and so my deepest sympathy to anyone who's had it, and particularly to anyone who's lost a friend or a relative. But we're going to die. For all of us, we are hanging between our birth and our death, and there is no guaranteed lifespan. And so, even Stoics would have made a better job of this than the Christian church has.
Mm.
One of the things we should have been able to say to people is life is a gift. It's lent to us. We don't know when the library book is going to be called back. Sometimes we have a long loan and sometimes we have a short loan. But we have no rights to own the book or our lives. But it's all the more important knowing that, I suppose, confronting the myth that we have a right to life and aren't going to die, which is one of the secular lies that our society and self-deception engages with, confronting that should have been a gift to the church. Instead, many of the church leaders closed the doors, denying the faithful the sacraments, denying them the opportunity to worship God and to say their prayers and to meet each other. It really wasn't at all difficult to organize socially distanced meetings. I quite like masks. I'm an introvert. I don't mind hiding my face so that I've got space to think before anyone leaps into judgment. I mean, I'm slightly weird, but it doesn't worry me. It doesn't affect me in the way it's affected other people. But if the price of going to church is to wear masks and to sit 3 feet away from somebody else, well, it's not hugely different from the way we've been doing church for the last 50 years anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But joking aside, I was horrified that the bishops locked the churches. Shame on the Anglican bishops who locked them even without the government asking them to. Some shame and some credit on the Catholic bishops who locked them first of all and then opened them when they realized what they'd done. Bless them. Thank goodness for that. So at a philosophical level, this was a wake-up call. At a church level, a reminder of how decadent the church had become and how we need to repent and to change our minds and to reconfigure our expectations and our way of living. At a political level, the most dreadful shock, if you told me the government was going to put us under house arrest for anything, I wouldn't have believed it. Only a pandemic could have done that, I think. More shock at the way in which 80% of the population think the government didn't go far enough. The level of infantilization and terrification of the population has really taken me aback. I don't have a television. I watch Sky News to watch the newspaper review most nights. I was still astonished at how much terror, the sponsored terror, the media poured out just that one channel. So I can see why people are frightened. But I'm just astonished at the extent to which people gave up civil liberty without any great fuss. Niall Ferguson said, we should go for a lockdown, but we won't get away with it. Well, they shouldn't have got away with it. I take the same view that the Lord Chief Justice took. Who is our clever jurisprudentialist? His name will come back to me as we're talking. Who said, the way we should have done this was to defend the elderly, to allow them to shield and to be safe, and to let everybody else who could catch COVID and experience either no symptoms at all, or even age 66 minor symptoms like me, unpleasant though they were, to go about their business. Why has he been a lone voice, jurisprudentially and legally and morally? That's obviously the only sensible course to take. And yet somehow we've allowed politicians who, under the pressure of social media, are terrified about having deaths laid at their door to overreact and to deprive us of civil liberties. So really no one has come out of this well. And what might we do? Well, we might agree that no one should ever have to say goodbye to a dying relative through an iPad again. We might understand that meeting human beings is an absolutely essential part of our social sanity. Christianity has always taught that. Christianity has taught that there is no isolated spirituality, any more than you can live like a sort of like an animal meeting all your somatic appetites. The opposite is equally untrue. You cannot live a spiritually pure, detached life. The incarnation, the fusion of the divine and the created, in Christ is the pattern that is real. And, you know, we have to pay proper attention to our socializing, our recognition of one another, the capacity to hug, to kiss, to hold, to accompany, and to have given all that up in the interests of hygiene rules that were muddled, unscientifically imposed, and politically driven was a great mistake.
Mm-hmm. Can one of the other big issues that reared its head was racism, or specifically the BLM movement, the Black Lives Matter movement. And I saw it as stirring up racial tension where there was not any. I mean, we're obviously a very different nation in the UK to over in the US. And the US does seem to have some racial issues in communities and how it engages. And I'm saying that from someone who's never lived there, just see that from afar. Well, we don't seem to have that problem here. And certainly coming from Northern Ireland, which is a mono-ethnic culture, and coming into London, which is a melting pot of every color and cultural background in the world, and you rub shoulders with everyone and life goes on perfectly normal. And that's just how life works in London, that people don't really bat an eyelid. But the BLM movement seemed to want to perpetuate this possible myth that racial injustice, or that this clash actually existed. And I think actually BLM, what they have done is make people now look at each other with suspicion, where that probably would not have happened before. So I don't know what your thoughts are on the BLM movement, how that's had an impact on our society.
I think there are two issues, and I'd call them, for the sake of simplicity, perception and propaganda. So the perception issue is the kind of rule of Meghan. Meghan Markle has been reminding us that someone can sit down and say, this is my truth, when it has absolutely nothing to do with an external reality. It's just a form of self-delusion. And the problem is, in a postmodern culture where all words and all truth have started to become filtered through a suspicion of the misuse of power relations, it's very difficult indeed to say, here are the facts, because there is no truth. They are my truth, or your truth, or Meganized truth. But the facts are, as you quite rightly say, that in the newspapers today, the UK was applauded as a model of a racially integrated society.
Mm.
You don't hear anyone saying that usually. I mean, a report happens to have come out telling us the truth, but you don't find the media saying that. So first of all, our perceptions are all wrong. Why are BLM getting away with it then? Well, that's propaganda. What are we faced with? We're faced with a propagandized movement which has set its sights on destroying capitalism, destroying marriage, destroying democracy. Well, capitalism, marriage, and democracy are really very important to us all. Capitalism, because capitalism has removed from poverty the greatest number of people ever in the history of civilization. I'm not in favor. I'm not a capitalist. I don't believe in it. But I recognize that, like democracy, it may have its very serious flaws, but it's the least worst system that we know. What it needs is taming and civilizing, and so the laws of the jungle don't apply. We can't afford a Nietzschean capitalism where the weakest go to the wall, but we don't have that. And the family is enormously important, because without a family, you have great human distress, psychological and moral and social anarchy, which we're beginning to get in cities where there are no families, and particularly where there are no fathers. And sexuality, because we need stable identities, and sex is a really important part of who we are, and to treat sex as something fluid, capable of being reimagined, lifts it out of the area of psychosis and mental illness, where, for example, confusion about, you know, where you have your mind thinking one thing and your body thinking something opposite that's actually a form of being unwell. It's not it's not an integrated expression of our humanity. So to come at society and attack it like that, and then for society not to perceive that that's what's happening, is extraordinary. I'm really upset that the English rugby team, half of them take the knee. The Scots don't do it. The French, bless them, won't have anything to do with it. The Irish certainly don't. The Welsh don't. Only the English do. And so when you say to them, what are you doing? They say, well, we're displaying our virtue. Rod Liddell is very good at this. This could only have happened in COVID. Because if they tried doing it in front of a crowd of sports people, they would have been booed off the field. Even, you know, even the crowd know that this is an Americanized, angry, propagandist movement that's trying to rewrite our history and bamboozle us. But the virtue signaling is now so strong. And people are so afraid of being called racists. And the thing about racism is the problem with the accusation of racism is it's too modest. It doesn't go far enough. Racism isn't the problem. Our inability to love our neighbors is the problem, irrespective of their color. Their skin color isn't the beginning of it. We dislike our neighbors because they're better looking than us. They're richer. They're taller. They're more loquacious. They're kinder. Whatever. I mean, the real problem we have is sin, and to hive off a particular form of sin and say this is the arch sin, and you know the rest of the stuff doesn't matter very much. That is such a distortion of reality. It's such a poor form of ethical practice that we shouldn't have anything to do. We should not allow people to be called racists. Apart from anything else, it's a thought crime. And you know, you don't know what's going on in someone's head. Of course there are racists. Of course there shouldn't be racism. But then there shouldn't be greed. There shouldn't be pride. There shouldn't be pornography. There shouldn't be rape. A whole load of things. But it's a thought crime, and that's the real problem with it. And the idea that on the basis of a thought crime you can't prove, people should be so keen to virtue signal that they buy into this crazed revolutionary movement that's trying to kick the legs out from everything that's good in our society, is just a piece of such stupidity that I wonder how is it possible our society is so stupid. And at that point, I was helped the other day by reading Paul's second letter to the Thessalonians, chapter 2, where he talks about the appearance of the Antichrist. So I don't want to get all apocalyptic. As far as I'm concerned, the Antichrist has always been around in one form or another. But he says, you know, when Antichrist seriously appears and makes its move in society, God will allow a stupor to fall upon people. Now, I don't know why God allows such a thing, but it does seem to me a stupor has fallen on people. And it's very difficult to explain it politically, psychologically, educationally, socially. So that's the point when I begin to reach for metaphysics and say, I think this may also be a branch of the struggle between good and evil.
There's one other little issue, and we'll just take a few minutes on it and then move on. We could spend a lot longer also on this other. I realize we're going through this like a whirlwind, but it's just good to get your thoughts on it, Gavin. Cancel culture, the situation whereby certain views are not accepted. We've always had a wonderful tradition in the UK where you've got robust debate and dialogue, where at the end you either change your viewpoint, the other person changes, or you agree that there are differences and you walk away. But we're now in a situation whereby those who hold different views from the big tech or a certain establishment or the media, those views are not accepted. They must line up with a certain view. And if you have a different view, that is wrong. We're not allowed a diversity of views. It's one view is accepted and you must sign up to that. And I fear for where that puts us as a society. So if we cannot have robust debate and dialogue on issues, then people are afraid to say what they think. And we actually could destroy any cohesion that we have in society whenever men and women feel they cannot engage anymore and they cannot talk about anything deep in society. So everything stays at the very superficial level. So what are your thoughts on how we will be impacted by this restriction of speech?
Well, I guess COVID should have warned us. There's a certain degree of parallelism, isn't there? COVID told us that people are primarily frightened and they're willing to give up all kinds of rights and responsibilities so long as someone promises to keep them safe. Cancel culture is a form of bullying, which is the thin end of a totalitarian wedge. It's totalitarian because it intends to police people's thinking and their speaking. Already we have literally the police turning up saying we need to examine your thinking to a man who was an ex-policeman. So that's what's happening. How is it possible, one then asks, that people are willing to live in the shadow of an increasingly threatening totalitarian culture that controls what they think, speak, and say? And I think the answer is because they've become frightened, demoralized, self-interested, and lazy. For some of that, I'm sympathetic. I'm sympathetic that people are frightened. I'm not sympathetic that people don't understand that society needs to be able to allow people to say things. We need to be able to test the truth. Again, we're back into the area of Meghan Markle and my truth. There really are objective truths. They're sometimes hard to come across. They need testing. They need working it out. Truth is not always easily accessible. You have to work at it to find it. But as Peterson himself said, quite helpfully, very often the only way you find out what the truth is when you get to speak freely. And that includes saying something stupid you later regret. The problem with cancel culture is there's absolutely no forgiveness. I mean, the idea of holding people accountable for a piece of stupidity 10 years old when you were 14 or something, how ruthless, how dehumanizing, how blood-curdling is that? Why isn't our society rising up and saying, we won't have that? There is forgiveness. People can make mistakes. People should be allowed to express themselves. We will live with stupidity and even some degree of hatred in order to be able to access the truth, because only by allowing the stupid and the hate-filled to have their say can we have a full panoply of reality in order to distinguish what is good and what is bad, what is helpful and destructive. Why? How is it possible that our society has become so terrorized that it's giving up freedom of speech? But it has done. And I think the reason why I get a bit more morbid, or maudlin probably is the word I think I'm looking for, is because I don't see any way of turning this around. If I sometimes seem in my conversation to be a bit fatalistic, or, you know, I the future of the church may be underground, the future of us of Europe may be in some form of totalitarian politicized culture with Chinese social credit working. The reason I fear that is because I don't see any levers that can turn things around. One of the reasons why I've been speaking out in the last 10 years since I began to see things more clearly is because that's I'm trying to fulfill my sense of responsibility to all the things I believed in and my parents believed in and my grandparents believed in and people have died for. And they matter too much, but I'm horrified that so many people appear to be willing to give up and to go for the comfortable and easy life and to lose their freedoms.
Well, let's move into a second part, change tack, but can I just bring up where people can find you? You're on Twitter at Gavin Ashenden. Easy to find, and also your website ashenden.org. So I'd encourage people to go and look. I think it was when I went on your website I saw the podcast you did with a Spectator on the Jordan Peterson interview. So I'd watched your video on your YouTube channel, but then I see that you've done something for the Spectator as well. So I'd encourage our viewers to go and follow you on Twitter and also make use of the resources you have on your website. As I'm sure they will find it beneficial.
Can I do something very cheeky? If there are any geeks out there who think that they can help me sort the chaos of my website out, I invented it in an afternoon when I knew nothing about it a few years ago, and it has grown and grown and grown. And I think it's probably now too complex for me to easily reconfigure it myself. And I have no spare funds to pay anybody. If, therefore, there is a kind Christian Democrat in the true meaning of both words, has the skills and has enough geekery to help, I'd be very grateful. If not, then I will leave it as a maze for the curious and the inquisitive to burrow around and find things they like.
Well, if anyone wants to answer that call, then you can certainly drop us an email, info@heartsofoak.org, and we will gladly pass your details on to Gavin. So, but can I take a little different track? When at the moment we have a strange situation, one that probably none of us have known in our lifetimes, probably not even during the Second World War, for any of our viewers who experienced that. And that's everything that the world, that individuals have put their trust in, a capitalistic system where our hope and our belief and our trust is in the employment system, is in the education system, is in a pay packet at the end of the month. And that security that goes with or has gone with all of those, that has really been shaken to the core. So I wonder how you as a church leader speak into that situation where what people have put their trust in actually has fallen away. And yeah, how do you speak into that situation and bring some form of hope?
My generation is a very privileged generation. There hasn't been a war that's caught us up. We've suffered urban terrorism from one interest group or another, it's true, but the great nuclear conflagration that I half expected to break out as a in my teens and 20s didn't happen yet, thank goodness. But consequently, we've had a very rich consumerist diet, and I think one of the things it's done inevitably is to spoil us. So it's very easy to expect a pension, fresh food, healthcare without limit, free education, freedom of speech. It's very easy to expect all these things and to imagine that somehow they're taken for granted without understanding that actually they all have to be defended. In a way, they've all got to be earned. I mean, as a parish priest for most of my working, well, as a priest and sometimes a parish priest for most of my working life, there were moments when I saw when I saw things very clearly. I mean, for example, I was phoned up one day by the Home Office because a lady called Peggy, who was a murderess, had got cancer in Holloway and wanted to come and live with her sister and die, not in prison, was given leave. So she was a murderess because her lover had two-timed her and she'd blown his head off with a double-barrel shotgun. In France, it's a crime de passion. In England, she doesn't get any of the kudos, which is perhaps rightly. So she came a Christian and was released into my parish, and I had to confirm her and prepare her for death. And the extraordinary thing about her was that she turned out to be the most vivid Christian in the whole community. It was someone once said, as we wheeled her around the church in the few weeks before she died, you know, it looks like someone's got a spotlight that's playing on that woman. It is, you know, what gives. And I had a very strange experience as she died. It was Lent this time of year, and I literally got kicked in the bottom out of nowhere. I mean, you know, there is no theophany of the kicking of the bottom in the Bible, but nonetheless, it happened. And I said to God, "Oh, what's that about? You haven't got anything against me. You know, the accounts are clean. What's the issue?" And I thought, okay, well, if it's not about you, you narcissistic idiot, it must be about somebody else who might be in trouble. Oh my goodness, Peggy! So Peggy had said, "I'm just asking you to be there by my side when I die." So I ran round. I sprinted round to her sister's house, and banged on the door and said, "I think Peggy's dying, let me in." And her panicking sister said, "Yes, how did you know she is?" And I ran upstairs and I held her while she died. And it wasn't an easy death, but it left the most enormous impression on me because I'm not saying all of us, any of us could end up in prison or any of us are potential murderers. That's not for me to say. I think I am. But I don't know about other people. But the fragility of the circumstances we live in, you know, we're only two illnesses away from bankruptcy and homelessness, any of us. We take, I think, for granted the safety and security of our lives. And they can, everything be blown up by a stroke, a burst artery, COVID-19. Again, it's partly the church's fault, but not entirely. But we have stopped living as if we're sort of suspended between life and death, and have, you know, we have a responsibility to make sense of why was I given life, and how am I going to die? These are really two very important questions for all of us. So in one sense, it's not a bad thing to have our trust in things we have taken for granted and kind of deified, sort of turned into an idolatrous web of pleasant support. It's not a bad thing to have them shaken. I'm not saying I want discomfort in my life. I want to be able to pay the bills. I've worried for the whole of my life about being able to pay the bills, and I hate it. But I do notice that it may not be a bad thing if the idols that we've built out of consumerism are shaken. But it will only be not a bad thing if we replace them with a relationship with the living God. If we replace them with drugs and escapism and a more determined pursuit of pleasure and nihilism and despair, then the mental distress that so many of our children already have had inflicted on them by the way we live will grow worse. I think despair and loneliness and isolation are some of the deepest afflictions in our society. And curiously enough, COVID has shown us that we can't live without other people. We can't live without people to hug and pray with and meet in a pub. We can't live without people to kiss and stand beside. You know, I think who was it who said just yesterday, you know, nobody should ever have to say goodbye to a dying relative through an iPad ever again. And we should have learned a thing or two in this last year. If we can act on that, that would be good. But once again, I think at Easter, it's an invitation to the church to say, look, this Jesus that we talk about quite often, you use him as an oath and a swear word for reasons that are really quite mysterious. It's strange how many people want to sort of unconsciously, it seems, abuse this extraordinarily wonderful name. I mean, forget cartoons of Muhammad with a bomb in the hat. Why is it that so many of our neighbors abuse the name of Jesus when it means so much to many of us? But we Christians should use this opportunity to say to people, you're living in a way that is actually dysfunctional and hurting you and not working. And we've lost sight of what gave real flourishing in our society. And most of it had to do with Judeo-Christian values, which is no real surprise, because the whole experiment in the first covenant was God taking a people and saying, now listen, live like this and see what happens. Learn to distinguish between the pure and the impure. Learn to distinguish between the holy and the unholy. Learn to distinguish between love and revenge. Learn to distinguish between worship and self-interest. And the Old Testament is this wonderful laboratory of the discovery of the holiness and the beauty and the love and the orderliness of God, on whom we're invited to build our lives. Built in a tight package in the Old Testament that then gets exploded like a flower with blowing its pollen over a whole field in the new half when Jesus came, making it available not just for Jews but for everybody. We've lost our confidence in that. We still allow people to talk about the God of the Old Testament as a God of violence and destruction, which is just a complete misreading of the text. We still allow people, we don't kick up a fuss when people use the word Jesus as a blasphemy. And yet everybody else is allowed to have a pet, a sort of pet ethical focal point. But Christians are not. So without complaining, I think these are moments when the shaking of society ought to allow us to pray and to offer ourselves for renewal and for repentance and for refreshment, to get a clearer sense of who we are.
During the time of the Second World War, we had, and I was brought up on Narnia. I read them time and time and time again, each of them. But obviously C.S. Lewis and his Mere Christianity radio broadcasts were there as to provide some hope, I guess, for the nation. We don't have that. The BBC wouldn't allow such a thing to be on anyway, but we don't have a clamor from the church. So does that mean the church becomes a very different type of organization? Does it go back to maybe what it was more in the New Testament times? Or I'm just wondering how, with the church not providing that role, which it really is supposed to, I'm wondering what that means for the role of the church post-pandemic, I guess.
Well, that's a very interesting question, one a lot have been thinking about. I mean, I think it's precisely because no one in the church has the church has not somehow produced a C.S. Lewis, that God has done it through Jordan Peterson, somebody outside the church. You know, it's a bit like Cyrus the Persian.
Yeah.
I even think that Trump may have been a kind of Cyrus the Persian. If you can't bring a level of, I'm not suggesting that Trump was a well-ordered or pleasant personality. I'm simply saying that if some of the kind of stable truisms for healthy living get banned for political correctness, and none of the people who have the responsibility to say this or notice this act, God may find an oddball from somewhere else to act instead. But that's not what you're asking. You're asking what the future of the church is. I'm afraid I think the future of the church is back to the first few centuries. I'm preparing for the catacombs. I think we've got another few years when people like you and I can talk on the internet like this and people can have access to it. I'm very impressed by a Catholic organization called Church Militant, who are run by a journalist and called Michael Voris. And Michael, some time ago, saw what many of us saw, which was what would happen to Parler. It was a surprise that Parler was just pulled by the technocrats, but it was within 48 hours. It was censored and it became a non-business overnight. And so one of the things Church Militant did was say, well, okay, we're going to own our own service and host our own internet. And all Christian organizations need to do something like that, because we will soon not be allowed on YouTube or the equivalent unless we tick an ever more draconian equalities box, signing up for things that either we shouldn't sign up for because we can't, or we'll be told we signed up for and we didn't mean it, and therefore we're off. So I don't think we've got very much longer left in the public space. And again, one of the reasons why I'm being fairly forthright is because it's now or never. We'll look back in 5 or 10 years' time and be astonished that we were able to reach so many people and say, why didn't we make more of the opportunity? It was our last opportunity. And I think we have to go to the catacombs. I think we will be forbidden social media. It's very likely that something like the Chinese social credit system will come in, where to the extent that you behave, you'll be given access to social education and medicine and technology. I used to smuggle Bibles into the Soviet Union in the 1980s under the Andropov regime. And along with the Bibles, I took genes and medicine, because Christians then were refused healthcare. They were refused access to some basic social services. And so we took in genes so they could be sold on the black market and they would have some income. This happened in the 1980s in Russia. It's happening now in China. And our society is moving in the direction of the state that Russia was in before 1989 and that China is in. So it's a no-brainer what's going to happen. And I think all the best thing we can do is to reconfigure the churches as places of living social and cultural rebellion. We are always in a stage of rebellion against this world.
We do not accept the narrative that our surrounding culture, which is in itself in rebellion against God, pursues. Mm. So this is nothing new, and it's just a matter of, you know, in whatever generation you're given life in, we take responsibility for the tasks God has given us. Well, okay, we are facing the destruction of a Judeo-Christian culture and the creation of an underground church in which we will invite people to be saved, to find new life, to discover how to live and how to die and how to have eternal life. Hmm. We just need to do it well in a way that we've not been doing it well during the course of my lifetime.
Gavin, I think we will maybe come to a close on that. I'm looking at our time, and I think that's a lot to think over for this time of Easter, whenever probably many people once a year possibly do go to church, and it could be around Christmas time for carols, it could be Easter time, and that's not really available to us this time. So I think that your words and your thoughts are timely, and so I think we
can I just wrap it up and say that might have sounded dismal, and if you put this in the context of Easter, then if we're looking at a slope down into darkness and difficulty, the whole point about Easter is Jesus goes there first, and he leads us through it into new life and into resurrection, into forgiveness and the power of the Spirit, into a transformed humanity, into the healing of all wounds, into an eternal, in all the things of love that we've developed a taste for become concrete and real in the kingdom of heaven. So, you know, it may be we're on the easy cycle of social growth or on the bad cycle, but the pattern is always the same. You have to go through death to find resurrection, and it doesn't matter that things are breaking out about us. It ought to give us more opportunity to throw ourselves into the arms of God. It's probably easier to throw ourselves into the arms of God when everything is being shaken than it is, for example, in the early part of my life, when it looked as though we were fully capable of building a better society by ourselves, though actually we weren't.
Absolutely. Well, Gavin, thank you so much for your time. It's always wonderful to speak with you, and I am sure that soon, whenever international travel is not illegal, you'll be able to move around. I don't know if travel in the UK is legal, but look forward to catching up with you over a tea or a coffee and carrying this conversation one-to-one. So thank you so much, Gavin, as always, for giving us your time.
Peter, thank you. And to you and to our listeners, the traditional Easter greeting, Christ is risen. He's risen indeed. Hallelujah. God bless you. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you for listening. Censorship is real. To sign up for our weekly email and find links to all of our platforms, go to heartsofoak.org. Please like, subscribe and share, and in the words of Churchill, keep buggering on.